Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with part of the team that worked on the beautiful and thought-provoking film 9 Days, which was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award for Best Feature Film and for Sundance's Grand Jury Prize. With us on the call are writer-director Edson Oda, editors Michael Taylor, ACE, and Jeff Betancourt, additional editor Zach Boger, and associate editor Philip Kimsey. This is Edson's first feature film as director, though he's directed numerous short films and has even edited several himself. Michael Taylor has edited films including The Farewell, for which he was nominated for an Ace Eddie, Skin, and the 2010 film Stranger Things. Jeff Betancourt has edited films including Black Christmas, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny, Poltergeist, When a Stranger Calls, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. Zach Boger has edited TV series including The Vanilla Ice Project and Get Out of My Room, and was an additional editor on the film The Outside Story and an associate editor on Lady of the Manor. Philip Kimsey was an assistant editor on The Woman in the Window and an editor on films including Brooklyn Love Stories and Mercy. He was an assistant editor on The Queen's Gambit and True Detective. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. There's great opening sound design. Talk about using that in the score to do world building right at the beginning of the movie.
The first thing we did really was we had about 3 weeks of collecting point of view material for the film. And I say collecting, it wasn't really collecting. Edson was actually directing scenes in Salt Lake City with Wyatt, our primary DP, Amanda playing the violin, for instance. We sort of have two kinds of point of view shots in the film. We have what I would call the primary stories, characters such as Amanda, Fernando, who is the paralyzed man. Most of that was actually shot in Salt Lake by Edson and his team there. But then we also had a team in Brazil shooting additional footage and a team in Los Angeles. And all of this was being fed to New York City, to Goldcrest Post, where I was working with Philip and with Kwesi Collison, who is our superb executive producer / post-production supervisor. And we're in this little room, and then we got an intern, Julia. And basically, we used as much sound as we could from the original footage, and we would amplify the sound. Of course, all this got redone and amplified and improved by Max Smith, who is our sound designer. Another thing about the film was that a lot of the music existed before we made the film, even before the POV units. Antonio Pinto had to write that violin score for Amanda to be playing. And actually, if you look again at the beginning of the movie, you'll see that Edson handed me like a 6-minute piece at the beginning, and he said, you know, at this point is when we see the child's violin. At this point is when we see she's having the piano lesson with the piano teacher. So one of the first things that I had to do was actually cut that opening montage in July. Like, there was a preliminary version, and I was always going back and forth with Edson saying, let's keep tweaking it, let's keep tweaking it, because eventually we did have to put a version of that montage up on the real TVs so that Winston Duke could be watching that, so that we could do the first shot of the film. The crazy part of it, which Edson talked about a lot, I remember with me in July, was that in July, Edson was in pre-production for the main part of the movie while he was in post-production on these POV units. This was a movie where we had to picture lock all these little stories, as we called them. I had a bin that I'd started with Philip, and my task every day was to sit down with Edson for about 3 or 4 hours because he had many other things to do. My goal was always, how many of these clips can I move from not done to approved by Edson, approved by Edson, approved by Edson. So then I can give them to Phil and Philip can figure out how to get them to the TVs.
Before you continue, I want to get Edson to explain to the people who haven't seen the movie, what TVs and what stories is he talking about?
Some people call it a spy-fi, like spiritual-fi. The whole story happens in this distant reality. I like to call it like a pre-life reality. We're going to see this interviewer played by Winston Duke, and he's going to interview souls. and choose one soul for the privilege of being born. We're going to watch his whole process that takes 9 days. And during these 9 days, he's going to see like a lot of candidates. And one of the candidates is going to be the one that he's going to choose, you know, be born. And the other candidate is just going to disappear. And the thing that Mike was talking about, like the TVs, is after he chooses someone, he's able to see what they're doing in the real world through their eyes. Like what they see, he sees in the TV. So he has 30 TVs in his living room. So he's going to be able to see 30 POVs of the different souls he sent to the world from like being born until, you know, now.
We would stay up all night and religiously, we actually photographed every single monitor over and over again in different sizes and in different configurations and with pans and with moves. And we'd be doing this at 3 a.m. And then we'd also be photographing all the VHS machines and pressing all the buttons like on, off, tape out, tape in, because we never knew what we would need. And it was a nice opportunity for me as an editor, because usually I'm always complaining about how come I don't have this shot? How come I don't have this insert or this close-up? But it was my responsibility to make sure that I had everything that we needed. So we have this scene, but it required a final visual effect. It wasn't just like we had to take a couple of things and fluid morph them together or dissolve them together. We actually had to create a scene that required a final visual effect and have that be done in July so that we could show it on the screen.
Yeah. And we were on such an accelerated timeline because we knew that if we got into Sundance, we only had a certain number of weeks to finish the movie and then get it to the point where people can actually see it. So I remember in October or something, I was like, Edson, producers are telling us we have to lock some final visual effects for the movie. Edson and Michael and I had only been working together for like 3 weeks at that point. And we were being told that we had to like start finishing the movie before we edit. So we're kind of like doing everything in the wrong order.
So all of that stuff that's in the monitors had to be shot and edited before you could shoot the scenes with the people watching the screens. Can you talk a little bit about the schedule of how the stuff that was in the screens was shot? When was that shot? And then how much time did you have to get it in the screens so that you could shoot the living room scenes?
Yeah, no, it was kind of insane. I remember like just in going to the meetings with producers. One of my requirements was just like, we need to shoot this prior to Prince Photography and everything needs to be done practical. And then later in the process, it was very hectic. It was kind of difficult because for the schedule to work, I needed to shoot all those stuff in the TVs during prep. So while you're prepping, we had like 9 days. We can shoot the Hero TVs. Hero TVs would be like TVs that has something to do with the story. So all those scenes, they were shot in Utah while you're doing prep for Prince Photography. And then besides those scenes, we knew that we need more material. Things that will happen like, okay, in the TV X or Y or Z, they're just like people doing daily activities. And when you start shooting, you know, like for the main TVs, we could do that. But I think for the other TVs, we just need to accept that it would be more generic, you know, material. But mainly so everything was edited. And then we said, okay, now we need to cut these things, everything here, so in the day we can feed those TVs. And the problem is just because everything, you know, so we didn't lose a lot of time on set. It was very, very challenging logistically. But I think in the end, we just found a way to make it work.
This opening montage where you're seeing the screens, you're realizing you're looking at people's lives. It's the first time you cut to Will. I was just really intrigued by the importance of that moment.
We experimented so much with that opening. It might have been one of the last scenes we locked, was that whole sequence at the beginning and how much to show of Amanda's life and when to introduce Will. It was difficult, but we would try and have like friends and family screenings with little groups of people every week because of our schedule. We could figure out pretty quickly that that was the best version, even though we lived with all these different iterations. But it was that sense of mystery. Like, what are we watching and how are we giving out these little pieces of information so that when we land on Will, it had the most emotional impact at the point you're mentioning now. There's a lot of experimentation to get there, but I'm pretty happy with it.
We already had these shots of Winston where he's taking notes on the candidates and we see them at different times. So-and-so, 10,497 since chosen. You know, instead of saying years, it would be the number of days they've lived on Earth. Because Amanda was our first character, we actually had an insert unit in LA near the end that wrote some attributes of Amanda, like a self-starter, a prodigy on the violin, things so that we could understand as she was growing up, Winston's character, Will, was noticing these facets of her personality. In fact, as I recall, the pickups were done in LA, but we were in New York, and I think you actually had a live feed of them in LA. It was like Zoom, yes. So you could direct them remotely, as I recall.
At the end of the first night, you see the TV screens, each person is starting to go to bed, the lights go off, and the main character, Will, leaves his house, and there's a fairly lengthy shot of him walking along a field, a darkened field with a lantern. Tell me about the value. Why is that shot there? What's the reason for that?
I think it was just to establish that there is this place. I remember because later we would see that again, but it was a lot about world building. There is this place where people just throw things and he can find his stuff just to build his last wishes and you know, the tapes.
I just resaw the movie myself a few nights ago. And Edson, I have to say, I think one of the most dramatic scenes in the entire film, and I'm not giving anything away, is when it's a black field and the spotlight goes on and there's Winston Duke pretending that possibly he's an actor. Moment is just so stunning.
Now I remember we added because of there's a storyline of the spotlight. Yeah.
And Steve, I know that the show you do is primarily for editors and post people to learn the process of how we make the movies, but assuming that some people have overlapping jobs, something to remember about this movie is that if you're a director, such as Edson, what happens is the producers come to you and say, Edson, your script is too long. We can't possibly shoot this script in 20 days. They say, Edson, cut 15 pages and we give you another day. That's what they really did. So Edson cut about 15 pages, including a lot of the material with the spotlight and some of the other scenes involving Keo, involving Benedict Wong. So the script got shorter, we got more days. Then every time I'm walking onto the set, I'm seeing, oh, I thought we cut that scene. In fact, I remember the last morning, it was like September 7th, it was 7 in the morning, I go to say, I thought we're all going to be drinking champagne or something like that. And Edson is there in the garage shooting the scene of the spotlight being fixed and that beautiful shot of the spotlight going on. And again, just a lesson for directors out there and for post people, because we can encourage our directors to do this. Even if the producer tells you there's no time to get these shots, if they're important shots, and if you've got a director who's really passionate like Edson is, you're going to get those shots.
There's a really interesting sequence as we come to understand what the movie is about. A bunch of people start to show up to be interviewed, and instead of seeing the full interviews of every single person, they're edited so that they're intercut.
We have like hours and hours and hours of footage of people talking about pulling chairs. And Michael cut like an hour long cut of it. And I remember my sort of first tasks was, how do we like sort of get this into something that we can actually watch? So I did one of the early versions of it, starting with one candidate and introducing the other candidates in the course of the interview so that you understand the point of the interview, but you don't have to watch the full thing. In the original way of scripted, you watch the full interview once with one candidate, and then you watch a montage with other people. We don't need to hear it. And then we're going to hear it again when Zazie Beetz's character is introduced. So we don't want to hear it three times. So let's hear it twice.
One of the brilliant things about that sequence that Zach did was that not only is it cool to have them all intercut, but you're also getting little glimpses of each of the people's personality and their character. You're getting a little bit of Tony Hale's humor. You're getting different aspects of them all. So not only are you just getting this interesting sequence, but we're already getting a big jump start on getting to know who these people are. And it gives us a big jump start to the movie.
This concept of seeing and hearing the same thing with multiple people extends throughout the movie. What were some of the ways that you treated or thought about those transitional repeats?
It seems that a lot of the initial scenes when Tony Hale comes in and he, you know, is shown by Will that this is a lamp, and then Tony touches it and says, light. All of that is designed to intercut so that just as we think we're going to see this one character get a whole tour of the house, suddenly Tony Hale becomes Maria, Ariana Ortiz's character, who then sees the shower. Instead of Ariana coming out of the bathroom, suddenly now that's David Rystal's character of Mike approaching the monitors. And then as we go to a reverse, now it's Bill Skarsgård instead.
And it was interesting because the test screenings, they didn't need to hear that or listen to that again, you know. It's kind of interesting how audience is very, very smart for those things. Usually we're just like, make those things shorter.
That's something that I have to learn and relearn on almost every movie I do, which is that the audience is smarter than we think they are. Yeah. And that very often we feel we have to put in two or three examples to make our point. So important to test your film over and over. Fortunately, in this period of COVID, those of us who are editing films right now, like I'm in one right now, our test screenings coming up next month are all going to be virtual with like Google documents afterwards. And that just really is going to rob the filmmaker of the experience. Like part of a test screening actually is sitting in the room and watching where people fidget and watching a scene that you thought was fine and realizing that it's painfully slow. Oh my God, this thing is dying. You need that in-person feeling. So hopefully we'll be past this in a little while.
I've got a question about pacing. There's an interview with Emma and I was interested to find out how much of the pace and rhythm of that conversation is led by the actor's performances and how much was specifically constructed. Now, obviously, that's something that an editor can construct, and it's obviously something that an actor can do. What was the balance there?
She play, you know, the scene in a way that she's kind of messing with Will's tempo. He's kind of this clock, you know, mm-hmm. when she comes in, she gets that power. She interrupts mm-hmm. him. It's interesting because then as you're editing that scene, when you're talking, I felt like, yeah, right away she's going to interrupt him. Mm-hmm. And I remember when you're playing that scene, we make mm-hmm. it through the cuts more, you know, clear that she's doing that. And I remember later, it was just as Winston wants to just like speed things up, she then starts slowing down because she's trying to just like understand better. Like, oh, because that's the way things are, you know? And then she's mm-hmm. no, but why? And every time we go to her, we would add extra beats. And then when you go to Winston, he would just say right away, we cut to her and then wait a little bit and she would say something. And then when you cut to Winston, he would say right away and you would just, and then we would play with this dynamics.
That was scripted, but we enhanced that in the edit. There actually was one time I came on the set, it was like at 3 a.m, remember? And it was in the room in the house that has just filing cabinets. And we call it the cabinet room. We did a wide shot and it's set like sort of by moonlight outside. And on one side is the Keogh character, the other side is the Winston Duke. And a fairly long scene, but it's really beautiful.
I think it's a oneer.
It is a oneer. And we were supposed to have close-ups. This was the unusual aspect of the movie that I was editing just off set. So I could come back and forth the whole time. And sometimes I would come out to the set just because I was really tired of assembly editing and just wanted some fun or wanted some craft service or something like that. And I watched like maybe take 6, 7, and 8. And then I just whispered to Edson, I said, why don't you just do it one or two more times? It seems really good. Maybe play with the tempo. But I don't think you want to do close-ups. So instantly, I was the hero with the producers. They were like patting me on the back and said, good going. You know, maybe we'll get out of here by like 5 a.m. In the end, that scene was really tough to cut because it was too long. Hard, yeah. And I think we had to trim really hard at the front and trim at the back.
Somehow we went sooner.
Yeah, we cut out of it sooner. Yeah.
Structure seems like in this movie, it could have changed pretty radically. Did the structure stay fairly similar to the script?
For the most part, we were locked into certain things because we did have the 9 days and keeping track of those 9 days and also day and night. In that, there were a few sequences that we were able to sort of move around with Emma, especially tracking Emma's relationship with Will and figuring out their relationship and sort of moving a few of her scenes earlier. So you sort of set that as their relationship a little bit more securely at the beginning. It was trickier than you'd think, again, because we were dealing with the days and nights and tracking them and wanting to be really clear that this was 9 days and not breaking that rule. But within that, we were still able to move a few things around.
Winston's character watches all these lives unfold in real time on these cathode ray monitors. They're old-fashioned monitors. He's also got a room in the house called the projection room. And he watches this character of Amanda growing up because he's become quite fascinated with her life. Edson and I had come up with a very long montage there that ends with a big fight between, I think, Amanda's parents. One of the first things that Jeff did when he came in, he said, you know, why don't you just have a couple of those shots and then have the door knock and then there's Zazie. And then that's suddenly we're having a really important a moment with the Emma character 2 minutes earlier into the film. There's a big difference between 25 minutes and 27 minutes. You know, people talk to me about that all the time. They say, how much do I pay attention to numbers in a timeline? I try to pay a lot of attention because you want to be at a certain point in the film, ideally, by this moment and this. And that was a great suggestion, Jeff, to cut that montage, even though we liked it very much. But I do remember when we did that scene that you talked about earlier, Steve, where Will leaves the house at night and there's a long tracking shot and we have beautiful music from Antonio and then he goes to the junkyard. I remember when I was first working on the movie with Edson and I was working with him on that scene, the junkyard scene, I don't think we had any music yet. And I think we were like something like 14 minutes into the cut. It was at that time, it was like 14 minutes and he's just getting to the junkyard. And nothing has happened yet with any of the other characters. I think I said it to you. I said, Edson, this is really a strange, weird movie. You know, do you think we can really have like 14 minutes at the beginning of the movie where no one even talks? But then I was thinking it's a little bit like Wall-E or There Will Be Blood, where you have these very strong visual openings to a film.
When I came into the film, I don't think there was ever much debate about shortening it, because for me, it always felt like a chapter close. Like we were turning a page, like that was back. Now we're going to take that and sort of do this chapter turn. And it is moving on to the next thing and sort of putting that opening, which is so cacophonous and so much happening and processing, to give you a chance to breathe, to be with Will for a minute. And exactly like you said, it's a chance to sort of move on to the next thing. And it's the first time we have score in the film that's not violin related. It's this is Will's theme.
How long was that first assembly? Do you remember? Because the film's like, what, 205 right now?
Sometimes I save assemblies, but I rarely do. Because as soon as I start working with the director, you know, obviously it exists as an Avid project file somewhere, but I sort of lose interest in the assembly at that point. And I don't have any sense of history of or archiving it or anything. And I know that everything I'm going to do with Edson and with everyone else here, with Zach and Philip and Jeff, is going to be much better than what I've done so far. But I think it was around 3 hours.
Do you cut the editor's cut exactly to the script, or do you allow for the editor to go, hey, look, we don't need these opening 3 or 4 lines. We can just drop this scene. Most people say, no, the editor's assembly should be presented to the director as he shot it and as the script. What's your take on that?
It was funny because it was my first feature. So it was more like Michael taking the lead. You know, like he tries to put everything, but also he adds his own.
I do tend to find the assembly is a place to stretch out a film and to see how it can work in its longest form. But also, I generally don't like to call it an editor's cut. I like calling it an assembly, because that way we can sort of say it's just a version of the film. I would not presume to know more than Edson what the film should be. I always figure that's something we're going to discover during the process of the director's cut.
How early in the process did you guys start using Frame.io in your collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, it was what we used for our dailies. It was the very, very first thing that we were using. As far as for collaboration, especially once Michael went out to Salt Lake before I was allowed to go.
It helped us to do a little bit of locking, but and this is nothing against Frame.io. It's a great product. But I think Edson and I both knew that we really couldn't lock these stories, lock these televisions, if I wasn't there in person with him. But for the rest of the show, we used Frame.io to pass cuts between us, to show cuts to producers, because some of our producers were in Los Angeles. In fact, for most of the edit, Jeff, Zach, Edson, and I, and Kwesi were all in New York, but the rest of the producers were mostly in Los Angeles. We would have test screenings in New York that we would project at Goldcrest.
Any other assets that you guys were trading through Frame.io? So it sounds like VFX, cuts, and dailies. That might be everything.
Well, we were lucky enough to have our composer living across the hall from us for a good part of the edit.
Yeah.
So we could actually, you know, he could come in, we could say, look at this, we did the scene, what do you think? And he'd go, okay. He'd run off to his room, compose something amazing, and then show him. And it was really an incredible way to work.
Of course, most of the time Antonio was in Brazil, but for the last few weeks, he was with us in New York. And he was also there later at the mix at Skywalker.
Thank you all so much for joining me and giving so much of your time.
Well, thank you for your warm response, Steve. We appreciate it.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. Also, it's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Experience. Thanks to my guests, writer-director Edson Oda, editors Michael Taylor, ACE, and Jeff Battencourt, additional editor Zach Boger, and associate editor Philip Kinsey. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.